Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network weekly lecture series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
Imagine Martian biologists coming to Earth and looking around. There'd be many things that would puzzle them and fascinate them. This is one. This is the scene, of course, in St. Peter's Square. And here's another. This is a similar scene in Mecca. And what would startle the Martian biologist is, here's this one species, Homo sapiens, engaging in stupendous outlays of time and energy, money, devoting their lives to these very expensive projects. And the question is, why are they doing this? What is this for? Why are they doing this at all? How did all of this originate? After all, it hasn't always been here. It had to evolve somehow. What is it for? How does it perpetuate itself? Now, these are among the puzzles that the Martian biologists would have to deal with, but others would be more obviously biological. Here's one that you might encounter yourself. You're out in a field, and you see an ant climbing up a blade of grass. And it climbs up to the top, and then it falls, and it climbs, and it falls, and it climbs, and it falls. And like Sisyphus pushing his rock, you think, what is this ant doing? Why is it doing this? What benefit accrues to the ant with this expenditure of energy? Well, if you ask that question, you'd be asking the wrong question. No benefit accrues to the ant at all. Well, what then? Is it just a fluke? Well, yeah, it is a fluke, in fact. It's a brain fluke. A little parasite, Dicrocelium dendriticum, has crawled into the ant's brain. That fluke has to get into the belly of a cow or a sheep in order to reproduce. Its chances are enhanced if it can get into the belly of an ant and the brain of an ant and force the ant to climb up high on a stalk of grass where it's more likely to be eaten. Salmon swim upstream to spawn, and Dicrocelium dendriticum commandeers a passing ant and drives it like an all-terrain vehicle up a stalk of grass. Spooky. Well, now let's look at another case. This is the three-spined stickleback, and here's the three-spined stickleback. This is a freshwater fish inhabited by Schistocephalus solidus. This is a parasite. Now, this parasite has to get into the belly of a bird in order to continue its reproductive cycle. So what do you think it does? It gets inside the belly of the fish, and then it turns the fish lighter colored so it's more visible, makes it swim right up at the top, darkens its eyes so it can't see where it's going, and also at the same time, by darkening its eyes, it shows the bird which direction the fish is going in, so that when the bird dives, it'll know which way to lead its target. And sure enough, this very often gets the Schistocephalus solidus into the belly of the bird, which is what is needed to continue its life cycle. One more example. This is Toxoplasma gondii. As the diagram shows, its final host is a cat. And this is a little thing, a little parasite which gets into mice. Well, what do you think it does to a mouse to make it more likely that the mouse is eaten by a cat? Turns it into a mighty mouse. It makes mice that are infected bolder, more less risk-averse, they run out in the open, they're more apt to be eaten by cats. Now, those are just three examples. There's many more that could be offered. In each case, what we have here is a sort of hijacker, a parasite that infects the brain and induces a sort of suicidal behavior in the host. On behalf of a cause other than one's own genetic fitness. No benefit accrues to the ant, no benefit accrues to the mouse, no benefit accrues to the fish. That's pretty awful, huh? Gee, I wonder, does anything like that ever happen to us? Well, let's remember that the word Islam means submission. or surrender of self-interest to the will of Allah. But let's not just look at Islam, let's look at Christianity. This is a rather bad, actually, photograph of a piece of parchment that I found in a Paris bookstall about 50 years ago. It was written about 1540, my scholarly friends tell me, and the words on it say, Semen est verbum Dei sator autem Christus. The word of God is a seed, and the sower of the seed is Christ. Omnis qui audit eum in my name, but in eternum, all who hears them will have eternal life. In each of these cases, oh yes, now I'll give you the, there it is. The sower of the seed is Christ. What we have here are ideas to die for, and there's quite a few of them. Islam, I've mentioned, and say Catholicism is an idea to die for, many have. Communism, of course, is another. It's not just religions. Democracy, justice, freedom. Yes, freedom is an idea to die for. You'd only have to go a few miles north to find that out. And people take this seriously. And what I want to point out to you is that no other creature does anything like this. Now, here, hard to see out, a show of hands, how many of you think that the most important thing in your life is having more grandchildren and great-grandchildren than anybody else? Yeah. Nobody. But that's the summum bonum of every other species on the planet. They can't get beyond that. That's what they have been wired up to want more than anything else. That is their summum bonum, but it's not ours. And this is a remarkable biological fact about us. It's what distinguishes, it's one of the things that distinguishes us from all other species. And of course, Mark has spoken about human culture just before. The way in which human culture varies the biological genetic basis and can modulate the basis that we get from our genes. We also have to understand that human culture is itself one of the fruits of the tree of life. It is itself something that has to be explained. Its own evolution and design has to be explained ultimately in biological terms. This is a page from a creationist pamphlet. I love this. It's hard to believe that this was meant sincerely, but let's just go through this. This is the atheist's nightmare, the banana. Note that the banana is shaped for the human hand, has non-slip surface, outward indicators of inward contents, green too early, yellow just right, black too late, has a tab for removal of wrapper, is perforated on wrapper, biodegradable wrapper, shaped for mouth, has a point on top for ease of entry, is pleasing to the taste buds, and is curved towards the face to make eating process easy. How wonderful creation is. The same pamphlet has another page in it, which I've made use of with great delight. This is test two, which you can now take. This is a little bit different from Mark's questionnaire. Do you know of any builder that didn't have a building? Yes, no. Do you know of any painting that didn't have a painter? Yes, no. Do you know of any car that didn't have a maker? Yes, no. If you answered yes for any of the above, give details. Yeah. Take that, you evolutionists. This perfectly captures, I think, what's deeply counterintuitive about evolutionary biology. At first it seems, well, of course there couldn't be design without a designer. There couldn't be wonderful creation without a creator. The very idea just seems nonsensical. And this brings it out actually rather well. But in fact, that's exactly what evolutionary biology has shown, beyond a shadow of reasonable doubt, that there are, in fact, processes, biological evolutionary processes, that yield magnificent designs that don't have a designer. Now, as Tom Ashbrook mentioned when he introduced me, I just finished a book called Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon. It's coming out in February from Viking Penguin. And in that book, what I pursue, among other things, is the theory which says it's ideas, not worms, that hijack our brains, and that these are ideas that replicate, that hitchhike on music, on art, and rituals that spread from mind to mind. They survive translation into other languages. And the effect of this differential replication of ideas through cultures is a major source of the design that we find in the culture, in all cultures. The designs that we find when we look at today's religions, but also at science and at music, at money, at art, these are in part the result of processes of basically competitive reproduction of ideas passing from brain to brain. I found a theologian with a wonderful quote: "If survival of the fittest has any validity as a slogan, then the Bible seems fair candidate for the accolade of the fittest of texts." Notice that this is a text that is fit. It's not that it makes you fit, it's the text itself that has a certain fitness. It replicates better than the rivals. And that reminds us again of the ant climbing up the blade of grass. It's not the genetic benefit to the ant that matters. It's the genetic benefit, the replicative benefit, the fitness boost to the hijacker in the ant's brain. So what this gives us is a really unusual, and I think for most people, deeply unsettling perspective on their own minds. The idea that your own mind is a sort of nest where replicating ideas reside until they can move on to other nests from mind to mind. They're using your brain basically as a temporary host, as an alternate host before moving on to other brains. A word for such replicating ideas, the word that's been introduced first is the word memes. It was introduced by Richard Dawkins in his 1976 book, The Selfish Gene, and it has been a very controversial term. A lot of people, I think, deeply dislike the idea of memes, whether it makes good scientific sense or not. There are some significant scientific problems with the concept of memes, which have been dealt with in various ways, and I deal with them myself in several books. But I think we can salvage at least the skeleton of the idea and put it to some rather unusual use in looking at the evolution of religions over a long period of time. According to Dawkins, memes are analogous to genes. They are to viruses. Now, what's a virus? Well, a virus, it isn't even alive, really. It's just a great big macromolecule, really. It's a sort of naked gene, or as I once put it, a virus is a string of nucleic acid with attitude. That is to say, it gets in there and makes more copies of itself, or it provokes a cell to make more copies of itself. And what a meme is a packet of information with attitude. It's something which gets into a brain and provokes that brain to pass it along, to spread it along to somebody else. And so it goes. The most obvious example of memes, of course, are words. Languages are composed of these elements that are replicated thousands, millions, billions of times. And the ones that don't replicate go extinct. I want to give you just a thought experimental example so you can see how this perspective plays out. You all know about the Shakers, wonderful religious sect, which is now pretty much extinct. And you might think, well, no wonder it's pretty much extinct, because one of their memes was the meme of complete celibacy. Not just celibacy for the preacher or the priest, celibacy for everybody. Well, you think, doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out why there aren't any more Shakers. But in fact, that's not why the Shakers went extinct. The Shakers were doing quite well back when they got going, because back in the 19th century when they flourished, we didn't have the social safety nets we had now. There were lots of widows and orphans around that needed to be taken in, and as long as they could find a ready supply of hosts, the memes could spread just fine. And it was only when social safety nets were sort of put in place that their supply of hosts dried up, and then probably the celibacy meme did play a big role in leading to the diminution of their numbers. But we can imagine that it was otherwise. Notice, first of all, that if your brain is infested with the Shaker meme, it reduces your genetic fitness to zero. You're not going to have any offspring at all, and no grand offspring. It's like there are many parasites, by the way, that actually neuter their hosts. And so the Shaker memes, in effect, neuter their hosts if they succeed. But that doesn't mean that the memes themselves are going to die out. They may still themselves be fit. In fact, we can imagine super Shakers who... they don't have any kids, but their ideas are really infectious. They're really good at spreading the word. They're really good at proselytizing. In fact, if you think about some other religions that you know about which put a great emphasis on proselytizing, you may realize it would be quite possible to have a religion which lasted for millennia, where none of the members of the religion had any children, but they all went out and got lots of converts. In this case, we would see that an idea can flourish in spite of having a negative impact on genetic fitness. But we shouldn't be worried about that, because we don't care about our genetic fitness, right? There wasn't a person in this room, not a single one of you, who thought the most important thing was having lots of grandchildren. But that's what genetic fitness is. So these ideas to die for are actually something that we're proud of. This is what makes us what we are, the fact that we don't just care about our genetic fitness. In fact, we don't care much about it at all. We are proud of the fact that we devote our lives and all of our energies, sometimes even happily going to our deaths in aid of an idea which has become lodged in our brain. Now, sheep. Not very clever, but there's one thing very clever of sheep. How clever it was of them to acquire shepherds. You see... what they did is they outsourced all their really difficult problems. Protection from predators, food supply, medical care, even assistance with childbirth. And the price of this was, well, you know, they gave up sort of free mating. And if you look at sheep around the world and you ask themselves about their fitness, you could carry off the living closest relatives, wild relatives of domesticated sheep in a few arcs. But there's millions, maybe billions of sheep in the world, and cows and so forth. What domestication did for all species is, by outsourcing a lot of their main problems, it permitted them, for one thing, to have smaller brains. All domesticated species, all, have smaller brains than their wild relatives, because they don't need them. They've got us to do the hard work for them. Now, one of the themes in my book, and I only have a few seconds left, so I'm not going to get into it, is that it wasn't clever of the sheep, of course. It wasn't the sheep's cleverness. It was evolution's cleverness. You should know Orgel's second rule. This is a coinage, a joke of Francis Crick's, which is that evolution is cleverer than you are. It's a stupid process, but the results are brilliant. And one of the results that we find in domestication is that once something becomes like a parasite, becomes domesticated, then it can be quite simple. It no longer needs to be as clever as it was before. One of the claims in my book, and I've now run out of time, is that organized religions descended from what I call folk religions, which were wild. They were like languages. There's been a lot of talk about language. Let me just end on a point here. Mark very nicely pointed out that you have in your head a grammar, but you don't have the principles accessible. You don't know, you can't articulate the principles. It's very hard for linguists to articulate the principles of grammar. And although there are grammarians around, scolds and word mavens and people who say, oh, you shouldn't use the word ain't and so forth, they're really not necessary. Languages can take care of themselves. They're like wild memes. They will survive just fine without any stewards. Written languages, however, and long division and decision theory and statistics, those are domesticated memes, and they require stewards who work very hard to train these along and pass these on to the next generation. Organized religions are domesticated versions of the wild memes that were their ancestors. And now I've really used up more than my share of time, so I'm going to thank you for your attention.
We invite you to download other lectures from the WGBH Forum Network at wgbh.org/forum. These lectures are produced in partnership with Boston's leading cultural and academic institutions. Funding is provided by the Lowell Institute and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.